This is ThinkWhy Radio, and I'm Amy DeGrappa. ThinkWhy Radio is brought to you by the Wyoming Humanities Council, bringing you people, programs, and ideas that make you think. And today we're talking to Damian Mander. Damian is founder and CEO of the International Anti-Poaching Foundation. Damian was a Royal Australian Clearance Diver, which is the same as our SEALs, and Special Operations Sniper. Welcome, Damian.
Yeah, g'day. How you doing?
You've done a lot in your life, and it's exciting to talk to you because I want to hear your story about how you moved from being a Special Operations Sniper to becoming a founder and CEO of the International Anti-Poaching Foundation.
Okay, yeah, no problems. I can do that. So basically, I served from 1999 to 2005 with the Royal Australian Navy and Army and the Special Operations Department. 2005, I left the military to go and work in Iraq as a private contractor and basically to try and make as much money as I could. There's an opportunity there to triple my salary and pay no tax. I took that opportunity, so I went to Iraq for what was the first of 12 tours, working alongside US forces, initially doing close protection, but then moved into training the Iraqi Special Police battalion-sized groups to replace the disbanded Iraqi Army and Iraqi Police Force. So after about a year, I moved into a project management role at the Iraq Special Police Training Academy in northern Baghdad, and we would recruit from the local population, often people with low literacy, train them up and send them back out into the eye of the storm. So I learned a lot of lessons there. We didn't do everything right. You know, we learned as we went along. There's no textbook on how to stand up a new army and a new police force in the face of an insurgency. So a lot of it was testing and adjusting as we went along. But I was learning skills that would later carry me through what would become my new career and not only the rest of my life, but define who I am. So after 12 tours, I went to Southern Africa, a little bit lost, disillusioned with what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And it's very hard to go from not only from a special operations community where you know the person standing next to you is watching your life more than you're watching it yourself, but then to go to Iraq and you're basically living on a knife's edge for so many years, and then it all stops. It can be very hard to fill that void. And I was fortunate. I started traveling around with an open mind, spending time with rangers in these wilderness areas, but at the same time learning about the struggles that they face on a daily basis, and seeing what these guys do. And not only seeing what they do, but what they protect and what they stand for. And that for me was something that resonated with me more than anything else I had previously done in my life. Iraq, you're going up against guys that also have weapons, and it's a two-way shooting range, that one. But when you see an animal, animals don't want much. They don't want a job. They don't want a car. They don't want a bigger house. They don't have egos. They just want one thing. They want to live. And we as a species are continually trying to take that away from them. And I saw an opportunity in Southern Africa to use my skills and the money that I'd saved by being in Iraq and with the military to do something constructive with the rest of my life. So I set up the International Anti-Poaching Foundation. We're now 6 years down the track. We've got the likes of Dr. Jane Goodall, who sits on our advisory committee. We have a presence in six countries. We have six major campaigns, and we've supported over 40 other frontline conservation initiatives with investments up to the value of $50,000 US. Our mission is wildlife conservation through direct action. We're very narrow and focused in what we do. We are the guys at ground zero, at the coalface. I go to work every day knowing that what we do is not the answer. And on this age-old cliche of winning hearts and minds, making the communities not need to poach anymore is the solution. But we struggle to see models that work and definitely not workable on the scales that are required to swing this huge issue around that we have. So in the meantime, I'm the guy that stops the hemorrhaging. We're the guys that buy the time. We're the rangers out there on the front line standing between rhinos and elephants and between poachers. And when something is being exploited, the most direct way to protect that is to stop the person that's doing it. And that's what we do.
How did you first come across poachers or learn about what they were doing and really dive into that work?
I'd heard about anti-poaching some years earlier, more of a romanticized adventure setting, really, discussed by some mates in a bar in Australia. And I won't lie, though, reasonable enough for a military guy. And I sold everything and set this up. So there's a group of people in this world that go out every day for up to 14 days at a time, risking their life. And it doesn't matter if you run an environmental NGO, whether you like photographing nature, whether you like going on safari in Africa, whether you're a hunter, whether you just like breathing the fresh air or drinking the fresh water that comes from nature, it all comes back to one group of people. And it's the group of people that go out there risking their life, not so much from the poachers they're trying to stop, but from the animals they're trying to protect. And these group of people are rangers. And for me, going forward in life, the best thing I could have done with the money I had and the skills I have was to support these people so they can go out and protect the heart and lungs of the planet.
As you've been doing this work, what have you learned about people who are poaching and why they poach? And, you know, like you said, you're stopping the hemorrhaging, but, you know, how can you go deeper and in a grassroots way help people understand the damage they're doing to the world? And are they doing it to survive and to eat and take care of their families?
I don't operate. We don't go in on the ground and operate, or one, unless we have government approval. Work with the local stakeholders, but two, unless there are community initiatives going on alongside the reserves that we've been asked to support. There's two different types of poaching: subsistence poaching, that's poaching for the plate, and then there's commercial poaching, which is like robbing banks or selling drugs to feed your family. We are the guys that stop the commercial poaching. We build strategy. What we do is we get stakeholders together, we build strategy to protect the hardest species to protect, what we call high target species. This is animals like a rhino or an elephant. Whatever the hardest animal in an area to protect is, that's where we set our sights. And what you find is that when you protect the hardest animal to protect, everything else in that ecosystem is being looked after. And when you weigh that against some of the bigger issues we have in the world today, global warming, deforestation, human population growth, the most direct thing we can do right now is to hold on to what we have left, and that's what we do.
How did your work in the military prepare you for what you're doing right now?
Yeah, I won't lie. It's very unfortunate that guys like me are required to protect animals like a rhino and elephant. I wish it didn't have to be that way. This is the world we've created for ourselves to manage. Rangers are being shot at and killed, and the animals they try to protect are being shot at and killed. You've got armed groups of civilians which go out protected by the local population, crossing familiar territory, conducting raids and ambushes against larger and less mobile but regular forces such as special operations, police, military. They then come back through familiar territory, still protected by the local population. That's a definition of guerrilla warfare. And you've got men and women who signed up to look after nature but are now being asked to do the job of a soldier. And I don't know what the answer is. There's people who are a lot smarter than me trying to figure out the long-term solutions. There's whole government departments working on it. I know that what we do buys time. We hold on to what is left.
That's interesting. Tell me who, in doing this work and in learning from others who have gone before you in conservation, who has inspired your life work now?
Two people come to mind, and they both sit on our international advisory committee. Just bearing in mind, we're six entities now registered around the world. Dr. Jane Goodall, of course. I actually probably don't even need to say much more than that. She's an inspiration, and what Jane represents is that conservation isn't just something we pick and choose if we're going to be a part of. Conservation is a lifetime commitment. It shouldn't be an option. It's like raising a child. If you have that child, you need to look after it. There's a responsibility there within that, and there's a responsibility upon all of us to look after nature in whatever way we can. This is our backyard. If we don't protect it, there's going to be nothing left. Dr. Ian Player, the man that, with his team, pulled together the last remaining rhino in South Africa in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and sent breeding herds out around the world when there are as little as 500 rhino left, southern white rhino. And today we have 20,000 of these animals left. Ian passed away late last year. But the fact that we have rhino left today to fight for is because of that man and what he did and what he stood for an entire lifetime. Both of them a great inspiration to me. Very humble people. Knowing Ian up until his last days and having known Jane for quite a long time now, you know, these people, they're not fancy. They don't have fancy cars or anything. They don't wear fancy clothes. They don't need that. They know that what they do makes them richer than anything else on the planet.
Well, that's wonderful. So I have one last question. Do you feel like when you left the military that you suffered from any kind of trauma or PTSD?
Look, I definitely know it's something that's front and center, particularly with the American public and the rates of suicide we have here. For me, look, you don't come out of places like Iraq after 12 tours completely unscathed. I've still got 10 fingers and 10 toes, but yeah, of course you still get anxiety and slamming doors and things like that. You're sort of clawing onto the ceiling. But I think one thing that has really helped me is getting back to nature and realizing there's something bigger than oneself in the world, and it's looking after nature, this presence that's all around us and the animals that inhabit it and the trees. And being able to look after that for me has given me great purpose in life. And so whatever has happened in the past, whatever scars there are, they are managed by the mission that we're on now going forward. We have a program in Zimbabwe called our Green Army Program. So we have people from around the world who come out and work with rangers on the front line in an unarmed capacity. But we also have a lot of veterans that have come out and spend time with us, not only US guys, but Australian, Canadian, guys from Europe. And they just come out and see that there is life after war. It's a new war that we're fighting. It's an endless war. But protecting nature, fighting for something that, in my opinion, is the most important thing on the planet to fight for.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. And thank you for being here, Damien.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
This is Think Why Radio, and I'm Amy DeGrappa. Think Why Radio is brought to you by the Wyoming Humane Council, bringing you people, programs, and ideas that make you think.